Hello and welcome to the Local Economic Development Podcast.
Hosted by Sean Cunningham
and Jörg Meyer-Starmer.
For other programs in this series, please take a look at www.ledcast.net.
In this episode, we want to share with you a conversation that we had at MISO Partners Summer Academy on Local Economic Development, which we had in Duisburg, Germany in July 2007. The topic of the conversation is local enabling environment. We are discussing this topic with Jim Tenburn. Jim is an international consultant who specializes in private sector development. He's also doing a lot of work with the Donor Committee on Enterprise Development and administrating their website. We would like to point out that Jim's statements reflect his personal view and are not to be taken as a statement on behalf of the Donor Committee. So here is the conversation.
Well, this is a pleasure. I feel if there's any hot seat, it's actually this one rather than that one. But and they also kind of crystallize a little bit the debate that's going on at the more international level at the moment about the enabling environment, because there are really the enabling environment, what's an appropriate role for development agencies. One school of thought is around getting the laws and regulations right and not much else. This would be spearheaded, for example, by the thinking of Hernando de Soto, for instance, saying that, you know, the poor actually have a lot of capital, but it's locked up because it's not recognized, they have no legal rights. The red tape is just hugely excessive in the poorest countries, ironically, the red tape is the worst. And you've probably seen some of the information coming out of the Doing Business reports, you know, that it takes several years in some of the poorest countries to register a business. So entering the economy is virtually impossible for people who are poor. And the cost of doing business reports have been phenomenally successful in raising the profile of enterprise development and the World Bank. That they've achieved many times the press coverage of the World Development Report, for instance, which was the flagship World Bank report. So this is rather, if you like, I mean, caricaturing it, it's the economist's view that sooner or later the market will take care of things, all growth is good for the poor, you know, dollar and craze sort of findings that the best thing that development agencies can do is get the level playing field in place and remove the red tape and unleash the possibility, the power of the opposite. But there's a completely different school of thought, which is saying, well, actually, if you look at the countries that have achieved spectacular growth in the last few years, the Asian tigers in particular. You know, you think of China, Taiwan, South Korea, Singapore, and so on. Shy of picking winners, you know, in the first school of thought I just talked about, picking winners is absolutely, you know, you must never do it. You know, public agencies can't pick winners. The second school of thought would say, well, actually, you probably can, at least to some extent, and you know, so Taiwan chose playing field. There were actually directive policies, which some of you mentioned, and interventions really getting stuck in there to orchestrate the development of whole regions, for example. Mm-hmm. And just to sort of finish, there aren't really clear champions in
the fact that doing business in many developing countries is a nightmare is something that has been quite obvious since quite some time. And nevertheless, taken up.
Yeah, that's a very good question, because it's true that for many years there was research showing that, you know, it would take 2 or 3 years of a firm's revenue to pay the license fee. I think some of the credit has to go to the doing business rankings, and actually, although it's one of the best known, there's about 30 or so rankings of countries out there in the public sector and the private sector. The beeps so true that if the government doesn't see any need to change, then what can an outside agency do?
So coming back to your two schools of thought, the first school of thought says, well, if you create an enabling environment in terms of reducing red tape, making legislation more transparent, streamlining everything, a lot of business dynamism is going to happen. The other school of thought says, well, maybe that's not enough. Maybe there's more things that we would have to do. How are donor agencies
cutting red tape and a lot of people getting out there? There are a lot of case studies now. The donor committee's done 2 conferences so far, and we've got about 100 case studies that were peer-reviewed that are on the internet. Businessenvironment.org is the database. And on there, there's lots of cases where red tape has been cut. So the number of days to register a business in Lima has gone from, I can't remember, 120 to 5 or something. So there are many examples where certainly, according to the case study, the amount of red tape, particularly around business registration, that for some reason that's been a major focus, has been cut. There isn't really much yet on what effect that actually had, other than increase in registrations and often, interestingly, increase in municipal
One of the things that I have often experienced is that there is a huge difference, or there is a relevant distinction between your stock of legislation, your stock of regulation, the structure of legal framework that you have, and the way
implementing, communicating, training people in, you know, what regulations are and so on. So there's often more appetite among development agencies for changing something that's a, you know, a headline event. rather than the sort of perhaps more mundane work of producing of
And I think this item, process versus structure, the process of applying regulations versus the structure of regulations that you have, I would suspect that there is a very clear-cut conclusion in terms of what you can do and what you can't do at the local level. But I'm not entirely sure about it. How would you see that? What can you do at the local level in terms of structure, the regulations that are in place? And what can you do at the local level in terms of process, in terms of streamlining things?
There hasn't been so much. I mean, as I say, most of the cases right now that we've had have been on registration processes. But obviously there are many others. There's been one or two on inspections, but otherwise there hasn't been a lot. There hasn't been much, for instance, on local government taxation, which I think is a very interesting area that hasn't really been explored yet, how local governments can and should raise business taxes. Yeah.
This is supposed to be a fishbowl. So if there's anybody who wants to ask some questions.
To establish one activity. Now is many activity or donor, I was talking about, they call one-stop service. They're talking about one-stop service. That means everything in there, transparency, they're really clear how many they, if they're asking to the government to establish one, say, one activity or one business. So what your experience regarding this call one-stop service? This is working or... This is just only like...
You partly asked, is it working? And I think perhaps the biggest question facing development agencies right now is, what do we mean by working? Which sounds, you know... superficial, but when you dig, it gets quite difficult because, for instance, some one-stop shops, taking that specific case, are an attempt or an effort to have one window where various different ministries and regulations and so on can all be addressed at one time. The trick is, how do you do that involving all of if that high-level political support stopped one day, then what would happen?
Let me maybe just comment or
I guess, again, I would be tempted to take a step back. To me, the problem in many places is not so much the regulations and compliance.
Clear picture, how many day for one sec, what you call is like they have some letter for the one business, how many
realized one day that nobody knew what all the laws actually were. So they said, if I remember rightly, every ministry had a year. And in that year, they had to write down in a book, one book, every law that was now in force. And there was a sort of a simple screening process so that nothing went into the book unless it had some basic requirements. And then at the end of the year, anything that wasn't in that book was out. Was just, you know, annulled. And I found that quite striking, because if Sweden needs that, you can imagine how much, some poorer countries might need it. And they have been fairly successful at that similar approach in other countries, where, you know, it's one way to cut through the red tape. It doesn't really address the problem of new regulations. I saw recently that in Kenya, for instance, there's constantly generating new laws and regulations, and unless you address that also, you know, any one-stop shop or first-stop shop, it's going to be regulations, and then the institutions, which includes the organizations and the rules of the game and the culture. So I think those are the three pillars.
I've got two questions now. My first question is regarding red tapes. How do you cut red tapes while there's political intervention? Because in third world countries, situation is not so advanced like first world countries.
Maybe you want to explain what you mean by political intervention.
By political intervention, I'm trying to imply that everything that
were coming into the sort of political sphere as well. This isn't, you know, I've been in some meetings where people have said, well, we'll do the research and we'll publish the results and then they'll change the law. Probably not, you know, unless you're lucky. It's much more around building the will for change and working with champions of change, which is potentially difficult for an agency to do. I mean, often within government, there may be one or two people who are really leading the profile of Wilfinson. Is a very good book, actually, and there's a chapter on the reform process in Uganda, arguing that it was, you know, President Museveni and his another piece of the jigsaw is this public-private dialogue. There's a whole website dedicated to it now, publicprivatedialogue.org, which has manuals and case studies and so on around mobilizing the private sector to advocate for change. I mean, in a way, long-term, that's the only durable answer, is that the private sector in the country should be able to advocate for the changes that are needed.
What I was referring to is the role of interest, because there are laws currently govern our country, but now the interest and the vision for politicians So would you then for agree with me when I'm saying an able environment is more relevant to first world countries, because a poor country is going to take some time before we can.
But obviously you're right that it takes technical agencies into political areas, and probably vice versa. It takes politicians into more technical areas as well. So it is a little bit much more complex than development workers have perhaps traditionally been used to. But personally, I would say the need is greater. However, obviously you're right that there's a big question about what an external agency can do. There are limits to what an outside agency can do, especially, by the way, if it sees its core business as financing other things rather than partnership and exchange and advocacy. But I don't know. I'd be interested in what you think about that.
I also concur with what you have said. It's just that most of the things that I've raised is more of timing. Conscious is something that you cannot quantify in terms of time, then it might take years.
So, Jim, in all the reading that you've been...
If there are any.
Well, there's a lot going on in alternative dispute resolution, ways of settling disputes between companies that don't involve, you know, the courts, but have some adjudication much quicker, much cheaper. So I think there's a lot going on that.
And impact on improving enabling environment initiatives, because for example the
they've had and other agencies have had. So I think there are sort of efforts to codify, you know, how to do it. But having said that, of course, at the end of the day, every country is different, and you need your champions and your political will and so on. But is there a particular area where you think guidance would
research and business assistance center. So this is piloted in Cebu and Davao City, and then it will be all the regions in the Philippines are mandated to implement that. And obviously Cebu and Davao have a very good business and investment climate if you talk.
Ranking tables of local authorities' business environment, and apparently that stimulated a lot of press coverage and maybe some desire to reform. So I guess I'd be interested in the use of rankings at the local level.
Yes, in fact, in the Philippines, we have this results-based management, and for enabling environment, we use the international ranking on competitiveness, and our government would like to instructions from our government to improve up to 99, rank 99.
So that's at the national level?
Yes.
I was thinking
also another GTZ project on ENRD, Environment and Rural Development, who benchmark with what this MEDSEP, the other GTZ project, has done, and that I think we are number one as far as the ranking of the Makati Business Club is all about. Our secretary has asked us to commit how many local government units will each provincial director like we target at the end of each year, so that all the LGU will have improved their.
Could say anything about the Vietnamese experience of ranking, because you were nodding your head, so I have to.
Okay, my name is Thi. Thank you, Jim, for introducing about the Vietnamese ranking system. In the last. And in the next year, in 2006, the An Giang province index increased more than 20.
Yeah,
very interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jim, I'd like to wrap up this discussion now with one last question, which relates to what we just heard.
I can only guess on why there is so much focus on registration, and I think there's two basic. My guess is two basic reasons. One is the De Soto logic that you have to make it possible for people to enter the formal economy, even though I mean you also have to think about the incentives and you have to think about ease of exit, for instance.
So there are many other aspects to formalization, but certainly registration is a big one, has to be a big one. And the other thing is that it's a headline figure that, you know, it makes sense and it conjures up an image of poor people benefiting in a way that some of the other things one could do don't. Obviously, I think everyone now is thinking now, how do we get into the other very important areas around rolling out laws, simplifying taxation is a big one. And there is also a discussion about what's the appropriate level of licensing. All would be best. But there are obviously many people who have a problem with that. The ILO, for instance, is not very keen on the idea of, you know, reducing labor regulations. Of regulation is a discussion that is, I think, only now just starting, actually.
All right, great. Thank you very much for your inputs, Jim. Sure.